devotees. That he would like to go to Vrindavan and he wanted to get their permission. And we know from Chaitanya Charitamrita that they declined several times to give them permission. They said, maybe you go a little later on in the year, this isn't the best time, or go after this festival, go after Rathiyatra. And he abided by that. He took it very, as a very serious thing. He didn't go against their permission, against their good wishes. Lord Krishna also, although he's Supreme Personality of Godhead, when it came to making strategies or decisions about practical matters, military considerations, he would consult with his good friend Uddhava before making decisions. So if even personalities like Lord Chaitanya and Lord Krishna made it a habit to consult before making serious decisions, how much more is it a good idea for us to consult? Because two heads are better than one. We may see things from one point of view. We're considering this is a good idea to do this. But if we consult another person, now, the qualifications of the person we're consulting or the person who's giving counsel are important. We don't just consult anyone on the street about some important matter. Show someone else, someone walks by the street. But of a qualified person, we know this Lord Chaitanya would consult with the advanced Vaishnavas, and the Prabhupada also consulted with other Vaishnavas. But therefore, the person we're consulting should be qualified as much as possible. We want the most qualified person to counsel us. Then we will have the most confidence in their decision or their guidance. It's like in our life, let's consider the whole spectrum of our life. How to proceed? What should I do with my life? What are my goals in my life? Well, we're, from the time we're little children, we're being molded, we're being guided by our family, our parents, by the school teachers, by society. And by the time that goes on for a while, we've got an idea of what we're supposed to be doing according to what we've been taught, mostly. We may read some books also, get some direction there. But generally, when we reach a certain age, then we begin to question, was this really, is this the right thing? Some people question, some people don't. But in the case where someone questions, I'm not sure that I should be doing these things. It seems to be that everyone's going down the same path and they're all unhappy. Well, maybe I should be doing something different, seeking something higher. At that point, one is in a position, he actually requires a spiritual master. And the spiritual master is the counselor that will have a tremendous influence on the other person's life, because he will counsel him about the big decisions that he'll be making in life. Therefore, spiritual master is spiritual counselor, and that relationship is one of the most important, if not the most important, relationship that we have in our lives. So we're accepting a spiritual counselor, and sometimes we may also be in that position to to guide someone throughout their lives. Parents. Parents are also gurus. Father's guru. Mother's guru. Husband is guru. And if you're a temple president, you're also a guru. Or if you're in charge of a department, guru. When you go on Sankirtan, distributing books, you're a guru. Because you're not just selling books. We don't just sell any books when we go on book distribution. We sell spiritual books, Vedic books, that will give guidance. And we believe in them. That's why we sell them. And we live them. And we know them. So we have a lot of confidence. That's why we're able to sell so many books. Others find it difficult to sell our books, but devotees can sell them quite profusely because they have so much intimate relationship with them. They read them, they know them. Now, we don't recommend that in consulting before making an important decision that we should consult with everyone or huge numbers of people. There may be some value in consulting with several people or something that one has to consider. But before making important decisions, some consulting is a good idea. And especially with experts in the field. It's quite common that when we have some unknown sounds in our automobile, we consult with a mechanic. We don't just take a hammer and start hitting where we hear the sound or speculating, because there's a lot to lose, and it's a good idea. We can save money and time and convenience by taking advice. For example, in the Vedic culture, parents would consult astrologers, generally, or an astrologer, before arranging the marriage of their children. They wanted to... It's an important decision, the child... Because in the Vedic culture, marriages were arranged, generally, at an early age for the participants. And they were too young, in some cases, or in many cases, to make a careful and accurate decision about such an important matter that they would have to live with for the rest of their lives. Therefore, how important were the parents to the children? They were acting as not only guiding them, but they even matched them with their spouse for the life. And the Vedic culture is that when marriage is performed, there's no divorce, they stay together. So, therefore, it had to be done very carefully, and they would consult with the most expert astrologer before making such decisions. It had to stay consult with ministers. Why do they have ministers? Because have to make important decisions, and we cannot expect to be expert in everything. And even if we have some expertise in many things, there may be other factors that affect our decision. We may be in the midst of an emotional situation which may color our ability to be objective. Someone may have spoken in a way to make us angry, and in that somewhat angry state, we may not make an objective decision. Whereas if we have a minister or ministers, we can consult. They, being dispassionate and neutral, somewhat divorced from the emotion, can give us good advice. So we're all kings in our own domain. Maybe modest, maybe small, but after all, we're the city of nine gates. We have our body, so we're the king. We have friends of this body. And we have our kingdom, our field of activities, and those who interact with us. Some people are working under our direction. We have influence over them. Therefore, we're also in a position where we need to consult. For example, how many times do we hear of parents, mother or father, getting angry with their children and beating them? Now, if they had someone to consult with, if they would get in the habit of consulting before they did anything rash or serious like that, then they could be spared that. They could call up their friend. They felt so angry, they felt like it was really beating their child when they got angry. But if they consulted, they could be saved from making terrible mistakes. So, it's a symptom of humility that one consults with others. And it's a symptom of pride that one feels that he doesn't need to consult with anyone else. So if you notice in yourself that you don't like to consult anyone before you make an important decision, you just do it, then that's an indication that there may be some pride. You're not interested in consulting. We have to work on that from our side. Okay, here's a question about consulting. It seems that there is some distinction between consulting with persons who are inferior on an equal platform and those who are superior. If we discuss with those who are on an equal level, then we view their opinion as less valuable than the opinion of one who is superior, or supposed to be superior. So when should we discuss with those who are on various platforms? Okay. Ultimately, the decision is ours. Everyone is responsible for their own actions. But, for example, in the military, one is expected to submit his own responsibility to the superiors. If a superior member of the military tells an inferior soldier to do something, he's expected to do it. And then the responsibility goes to the higher officer. Otherwise, there's punishment. On the spiritual platform, a disciple is supposed to have implicit faith in spiritual master or a mentor. And sometimes the advice of the mentor or spiritual master may not agree with the disciple's idea. So what to do then? This is a difficult question. And of course, we're taught in the West, don't put too much faith in anyone else's advice. Better to make your own decisions. So therefore, they have a problem, that they have a serious problem with accepting the spiritual master very seriously, because they're afraid that they'll be cheated. Of course, they don't consider that they're already being cheated by following their minds. They're putting their full faith in their minds and their so-called intelligence and their senses. And they follow that advice, or those urges, or those feelings, rather than putting their trust in a spiritual guide. But, same thing with a monarch. Prabhupada said that he considered the monarchy to be the best system. Of course, it wasn't just his opinion, that's also the Vedic system. That, at least for a social system, monarchy is best, but it depends on having a good monarch. If we have a bad monarch, bad king, well then it's going to be a problem, like King Dana. He made havoc. But a good king, like Parikshit, like is too much. We can, one such person is better than thousands of less qualified persons making decisions. Especially when it comes to managing the state, which requires expertise in that field. Not everyone knows how to manage a state, but one person who's trained can guide the whole state. For example, let's say you're flying in an airplane, a big airplane. So, let's say there's 300 people on board. And one person is trained as an airplane driver, flight pilot, and the others are not. Who would you prefer to have fly? Well, I'm sure that everyone would say we want the pilot, the one who's trained, to fly. Each flight, let's say you have to take 5 flights. So on each time, because you're democratic, you know, nice vote, all those, how many vote for this person? How many vote for this person? Everyone would vote for the pilot. It's almost like he has a monarchy over that whole sphere of activity of flying. In other words, you wouldn't want to experiment. Well, let's let, you know, this person over here hasn't flown yet. Let's let them do it. There's a nice looking young man. Give him a chance. Why should we be so restrictive? Let's be more egalitarian. Let's be more equal. Right? No one was looking for that. No intelligent person. Because it requires such expertise and such training. And if we don't have that expertise, if we don't have that training, then the driving will be a complete catastrophe. The flying in the airplane. So it's the same thing in life. It's the same thing in a state. Managing a state without being properly trained or experienced is a catastrophe. And we see practically every country in the world is a catastrophe. So we believe it when it comes to flying airplanes, but we don't believe it when it comes to flying states, organizing a state, nor do we believe it when it comes to taking advice for our life. What's the use of consulting so many people who don't know how to live? They're not trained how to live their life. They don't know what the purpose of life is, nor do they know how to live themselves. But somehow or other, as we see, it comes out that we think when it comes to certain aspects like spiritual things or like leading a country, making decisions about how we should live our lives, then we trust our own judgment or the judgment of persons who are unqualified. Such important things. It's like school teachers. We put our trust in people to teach who may not be educated or experienced, at least according to the Vedic standard. Now, the disciple, he agrees to follow the spiritual master's directives, but if he only agrees when the spiritual master's instructions coincide with his own, then he's not accepting the spiritual master with complete authority. And of course, Prabhupada taught us again and again and again that one must have implicit faith in the spiritual master. This is the unique thing, or one of the unique things about Prabhupada, is that he was uncompromising on this factor. Even in the face of the liberal Western ideas, he was in New York, who accepted anyone else with such authority? Everyone was thinking, I'm okay, you're okay, whatever path you want to follow is alright, especially in the spiritual matter. Prabhupada didn't compromise on that. But there's a connecting point, and that is that the teacher or the authority must be qualified. Otherwise, not responsible to follow completely. Now, let's say, because the question was, how do we know when to, how do we deal with taking advice or counseling from a superior, from an equal, or from a subordinate? Well, yes, we can take counsel from any of those three, but there may be, it may be different in terms of the trust we put in it. For example, if we go to, say we have something wrong with our car, now we go to the top master mechanic, and we ask him to please give us some advice. Okay, then he does an examination, a diagnostic test, everything. He's got all the credentials, and he said, this is what needs to be done. Now, to not take that very seriously, we're expected to take it very seriously because of his qualifications. And to doubt him or to disregard his instructions is not a very good use of his counsel. On the other hand, let's say there's something wrong with that car, and our next door neighbor, who is not a master mechanic, but, you know, tinkers around sometimes, you know, puts his own spark plugs in sometimes, changes his own oil. So you ask him, would you mind taking a look at the car and see if you can give any suggestions? So, his advice will not be taken as seriously, as important as the master mechanic. Similarly, the friend, his advice will also be based on his expertise. If he's not so expert, he'll say, I'm not sure, but it might be this. Okay, now he's being honest, that's good. He's not saying it's absolutely this, because he doesn't know for sure. He's not that experienced. That's good. That means when you're taking counsel from him, you know that I don't have to put so much confidence. I don't have to have implicit trust in his advice. Now, you can also take advice from subordinates. This is quite popular now. Everyone or companies, they do surveys. They say, please evaluate your teacher, evaluate. Well, they're in a subordinate position in one sense. They're sitting there being instructed. But in another sense, they can be considered superiors because in terms of evaluating the teacher, you know, they are suddenly they're in a position where they're able to evaluate. They become superior. So in taking surveys, we may actually get some valuable feedback or input from even subordinates. Now in the Vedic culture, the consultants, ministers, teachers, or mentors were always among the Brahmanas. And why? Because a Brahmana was well educated in all the important aspects of culture. Well educated in cleanliness, mental control, bodily control, sense control, intellectual capacity, spiritual guidelines, all the etiquette, everything. Therefore, such advice would be suited, would take into consideration all the factors that are required when teaching a child. Let's say, for example, you would like your child to learn something about electronics. Okay? And it so happens that there's one man who's very good at electronics. The only problem is he's a serial killer as well. Does anyone know what a serial killer is? Well, it means that from time to time, he has he has a tendency to go out and shoot many different people to kill them. He doesn't do it all the time. Not necessarily habitual, but from time to time. Now, he may be a really expert in electronics, you know, maybe one of the best. Would you, as a parent, send your child to learn electronics from him? How many, raise your hand if you would send your child. After all, he's good at electronics, and you want your son to be good at electronics. Raise your hand if you'd send your son there. You would. No. Don't take your house to that. So, we wouldn't. Because, why? Because although he might teach him some correct things about electronics, what are we afraid of? We're afraid of his character influencing my child. That horrible, maniacal, violent character, that insanity. We're afraid that that's going to influence the thinking or the consciousness of my child. Therefore, we would not send our children to such a teacher, even if he was expert. Therefore, when people say, and they do, it doesn't really matter about the qualities of the person who's a teacher, they are nonsense when they say that. And they do. Because we say, you can't be a teacher until you're qualified. And they say, his personal life doesn't matter as long as he knows the subject matter. Then I always give him the example, okay, Charles Manson, the serial killer. Would you want your children to be trained by him? Even if he was good in English, would you like them? And they say, well, no. Well, not when it's that bad. But it is. That you may say it's degrees. It may not be as bad as a serial killer, but what if he's a meat eater? Oh, well, that's not so bad. He only slaughters, he only eats cows. You see, for us, we have a different sensitivity. I'm speaking to Vaishnavas now, devotees. Our sensitivities are different. We have been educated in a finer, in a higher level of knowledge. Therefore, for us to take advice, especially on important subjects, from those who eat cows, for example, we should be quite reticent about doing that. I remember there was some years ago, there was some discussion about learning from a particular person who was supposed to be quite expert in several steps of, you know, self-improvement and management and things, and he'd written books and, you know, seminars. And many were thinking that this was really kind of a landmark breakthrough, and we're going to really become well guided in that. Well, I'll tell you something. That person, he boasted that about his barbecue. He used to have barbecues. He may have been a pious man according to ordinary considerations, but Vaishnavas should have felt the pulse. Well, he's also having barbecues. You know what that means. Eat mother cow. So, now, we may be thinking, I'll just take the gold from a filthy place. Because Chanakyapana did say that. But when we take gold from a filthy place, we also may get a lot of filth. And we may not get so much gold, we may get mostly filth. Or you may get a little bit of gold and a lot of filth. So we have to consider very carefully how we will be able to extract the gold nugget and leave everything else behind. We may not be able to do that. And I will say that in the case of that particular person, the advice he was giving was not just mechanical. Even if it were, we already discussed the serial killer and electronics. We wouldn't even want to have our child learn electronics. That's, you can't get much more mechanical than that. You put this wire here, but still we wouldn't want that association. what to speak of other things, about how to live your life, what ethics you follow. Like the big word now is integrity. In any kind of seminar, everyone's talking about integrity. But integrity according to whom? Who's deciding what the integrity is? He's having barbecues. And he considers that he has integrity. And he's going to teach us about integrity. He's going to teach his students. According to society nowadays, you can still have abortions and be a man of integrity. You can do so many things and still be considered a person who has integrity. Because their idea of that word integrity is something completely different. It's all superficial. How people observe you, how you appear to others, you don't get caught doing bad things. Everyone does bad things, but you don't get caught, therefore you can claim to be. So we have to consider very much, and the Vedic culture will not even allow anyone to take any of those positions of teacher unless they're trained as Pakka Brahmins. And there's a reason for it. And I'm trying to express that. Does anyone have any questions about that? Because it's a very important topic.
We see several times temples taking consulting from outside firms, which are obviously good leaders, in matters of public relations, religious donations, how to build a Mayapur temple without affecting the Ganges water. Mm-hmm. Then you can comment on this standard.
Yeah, it can be done. But one hand, with great caution, with great care. An example is always given that, well, when you have something wrong with your car, you go to a mechanic, it doesn't matter whether there's a mediator or not. Okay? So, we say then, what's wrong with going to a psychologist or a counselor or a psychiatrist or whatever? Because we're dealing with the body, and the body's like a machine. So it's the same thing as an automobile. Well, not exactly the same. There are some differences between an automobile and the mind, especially when we're talking about people giving us advice on how to think, and how to feel, and how to act. Okay? Just like you may go to a doctor and he may recommend that you eat red meat because you're lacking some nutrients. Well, there is a difference there, isn't it? You may say, well, I have to follow his advice. He's an expert. But he may be an expert on one level, but not necessarily on taking into consideration everything. He may be lacking in... He may have blind spots. He may be uneducated in certain areas. For example, he may think that red meat is just perfectly good and makes you strong and healthy. We don't necessarily agree with that. Therefore, we want to know the overall background and credentials of a person. Especially when it has to do with giving advice about how to think and how to live. And generally that's practically everything. Especially when it comes to any of these systems, like self-improvement systems or management systems. It's all about that. How to think, how to act, what are principles of integrity? What are principles or goals? If the person we're learning from considers the goal of life to make money, as often they do, what do you think you're going to get from that course? What is the point he's driving home from every possible angle?
Some other make money.
Yeah, that's right. And he may not say it directly every minute either. Just like I'm giving a seminar too. Well, my goal is I want people to become Chaitanya Krishna. And it comes out. Now with this group, you may notice that it's quite, it comes out in a more prevalent way. If I were speaking with a group of persons who were not devotees, it would be more subtle. Okay. But still, it'll come out because that's why I'm here. I'm not here to make money, and I'm not here to make people better materialists or any other consideration. So similarly, we have to consider what is the number one meditation, what is the standard of the person who's teaching, what does he stand for? And if his goal, if he lives on the principle of making money, that's what you're going to get. And if you think that I'll extract the part about getting money, but I'll leave aside the materialistic aspects, maybe. Maybe you will, but maybe you won't. And therefore, Rupa Goswami has cautioned us, not cautioned us, that's a light, that's too light. He said that associating with non-devotees is more dangerous than living in a cage of fire or living in a cage with a lion. You know, well, this is a fanaticism. Well, if Rupa Goswami is a fanatic, we've joined, that's the movement we've joined. We are Rupa Lucas. So we have to consider. When Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was asked by a devotee, can you explain to me how do I know what a Vaishnava is? Lord Chaitanya's response was, asat sangatyaga e Vaishnava cha. A Vaishnava behaves, you can tell who is a Vaishnava because he does not associate with the asat. He gives up the association of non-devotees. Please consider this when you're consulting. Be very, very careful because your consciousness is the most valuable thing you've got. And if you allow your consciousness to become affected, or the consciousness of those under your care, if you allow their consciousness to be affected by others who are not pure, who do not have pure consciousness, then you'll be responsible for that. And you'll suffer. So your question is, how are they supposed to interact? For example, let's say you work in a company and the boss says, okay, I want you to learn how to do accounting from this person. Okay, so now that's your duty. So, should I say, well, I'm sorry, he's a mediator. I mean, I don't take instructions from mediators. Well, you'll be fired. Although, you might not. Actually, there's one... We have one brahmachari, and he decided he wanted to become a grihastha, that's a lot of growth. And so he wanted to be a truck driver. That's the service that's what he wanted to do during his livelihood. Although, you know, others tried to suggest other possible jobs, but he was attracted to being a truck driver. Okay, so he went to his training for truck driving. Then he got a certificate, and then he started consulting with different trucking companies. And he told them that he didn't want to carry, you know, this, weed products, intoxication products. He went through quite a list. He didn't want to be implicated in the karma of transporting these things. But still he was willing to drive the truck. So it turned out that there were a couple companies that just dealt in carrying rocks, you know, stones, sand, and wood, things that he didn't consider that would compromise his principles. So he went to work with them. So there are some, in other words, we can't be discriminating to a certain point, depending on our... Now, he might have gotten a little more money, and it might have been a little more convenient for him had he not put all these conditions. As it turned out, he may have had to work for a company that was a little further away from where he was living. so he may have had to make some adjustments. But for him, it meant so much that he didn't want to be implicated in the conspiracy of those activities. He just couldn't live with himself. He said, okay, you have to carry it. You drive this truck, you know, with the animals going to slaughter. I mean, he couldn't do that. So, depending on our level of sensitivity or desire to remain clean, then we may put conditions and we may be willing to accept the consequences of that. For example, I was also drafted into the Israeli army as a devotee. And, of course, I didn't want to be drafted, and I didn't want to fight. But they were trying to train me up to be a soldier and engage me in the war that was going on over there in the Middle East. So, I agreed to go in the army because it was either that or I had to leave the country, but I was preaching, so that was. And I agreed to certain things that they asked me to do. They asked me to carry the gun, the rifle, and I agreed to carry it, but I wouldn't shoot it. I said, I'll carry it, I won't shoot it. And I also lost my bullets. So one time when they said, all right, now you have to guard the ammo dump at night. You know, there was a big ammunition supply. It's very important because if the enemy could blow that up, it would not only blow up the base, but it would also blow up all the ammunition and the people. And it was very, so they asked me, not asked me, they ordered me, now you have to guard the ammo dump. And I said, well, I have no bullets. And besides, I won't shoot. So, I'm not disagreeing with your order. There's just a few conditions. They wanted me to wear their, you know, the boots. I had to wear the combat boots. I said, no, I don't wear leather. So what do you mean you don't wear leather? I said, it's one of my principles. So they let me wear Birkenstocks. My non-leather Birkenstocks I was wearing. I was the only one, I think, that was allowed to do that. Of course, it wasn't really the best for combat, but I knew I could get away with certain things, and I did. And it made my experience very Christian conscious, although it wasn't easy. For example, they didn't want me to have a shaved head and a sheikah. But I said, based on my religious principles, I want to do this. So they had to agree. And I shaved my head every day just to make sure it was always shining. And I purposely lost my hat so everyone would see my shaved head and peel out every day. And of course that irritated them and made, you know, disturbances. And many times they threatened to put me in the jail.
The prison. Brigade?
Hmm?
Brigade? They don't call it a brig or something like that?
Yeah, something like that. Yeah, jail. So, but generally I would push just to the point where they wouldn't do that. But because I did not want to participate in their activities, I did not agree with the basis of the war. They tried to indoctrinate me that these people are our enemies because they will kill you, because they hate you, therefore they are our enemies. So I tried to explain to them a higher principle, that we're fighting basically for sense gratification. One group is fighting that they want to use the land for their sense gratification. The other group is fighting they want to use the land and the resources, but they want to be in control, and they want to have sense gratification in their particular way. This is not a good basis for fight. And I explained all these things. So, the point I was trying to make was that we can be quite discriminating in our dealings with materialistic purposes. Provided we're willing to make the to undergo the austerities that it requires. Okay? Now, the stronger we are in spiritual life, the more we're willing to undergo the austerities to stand up for our principles. Okay? So, it doesn't mean that when I was there, I said, I cannot speak with any of you because you're mediators. Had I gone that far, it would have been ludicrous. But I was willing to speak with them. And I was willing to live with them and do what they said, you know, as long as it went along with my views. For example, if you work at a company, let's say they say, now everyone in our company must eat this for lunch. You would say, no, I'm sorry, I can't eat that. Same thing with your child. If you send your child to a school and they only serve in the cafeteria meat, well then, you say, I can't send my child to that school. So there has to be some discrimination based on your principles. And doesn't mean we can't interact. We don't have to call everyone a mediating demon every time we see them. But we also have to be careful of what we're taking from them. As we become very intimate, and if we start becoming intimate with them, then we will imbibe their lower qualities, and we will be affected. Intimate means we start, you know, spending a lot of eating with them, associating with them. So you may say, but gee, you're telling me that I have to work in the company, but I'm not supposed to make any friends? What is that? You're telling me to be unfriendly? I thought one of the qualities of a devotee is friendly. He is friendly. But he's friendly. He's a friend to all living entities, Sudidam Sarvadehina. But what is that friendship based on? It's based on giving that person Krishna consciousness. It's not based on taking material ideas from another. Now one has to be expert to do that in such a way that the person that we're befriending doesn't object. We may give the dose of Krishna consciousness to that other person in a very subtle and gentle and long-term way. It may not be on the first day I tell him, you know, God is blue and he plays a flute. That may not come for years, or it may not come at all. But still, I can give that person, because he's my friend, I can give him the best thing I've got, which is knowledge of Krishna. But I may have to do it in a subtle or gradual way. Okay, does that clarify the point? And you can get along. For example, when I was in the Israeli army, I made friends. I never expected to make friends there. But because we were in a very intense situation, we were all thrown in the situation where it was a life or death, you know, life or death situation. Even though I was not exactly cooperating according to their idea, according to God's idea, I was cooperating because I was giving them all Krishna consciousness. And they could appreciate that on some level. So at the end, after the it wasn't for a long term, it was for a few months I was in the basic training. After that training was over, we all found, surprisingly, that we had become very, very close friends. And it was surprising to them. We were all crying when we were embracing each other at the end. It was as surprising to them as it was surprising to me. But because Krishna had become the center of the relationship, not according to their desire, but according to my desire, and somewhat to their desire, it's not by accident they got that the whole thing had become more intimate than you would expect, and it became very nice. I didn't get affected by their bad qualities, but they did get affected by my Krishna consciousness. So that was an example of how we can do that. You can do that in business also. You won't be touched. You'll be like a lotus flower, untouched. As long as you keep your principles and you're expert, you can do that. And they, on the other hand, will get the good benefits of the devotees' association. And you will be friends, but you'll be friends. You'll become friends on your terms or on Krishna's terms. like there's one group, a big religious group in the Middle East that we've been cultivating for many years. They have a great deal of respect for the Vedic culture, but they still have some habits that we find unacceptable. But when they invite us to come to their homes or to visit with them, they respect our principles, and they only serve foods that have no meat, fish, or eggs in them. And even though they're meat eaters, we associate with them, but on the terms that are favorable for their advancement and for our advancement. So the result is that gradually they're coming up. They're gradually getting to the point where they're beginning to think that they should give up these bad habits. And as long as we're careful and we don't compromise, then we won't be affected. If we do compromise, then we've lost. So keep that in mind in taking counseling from others, that don't compromise your principles, because that's your most important thing. You know the story about the Hindu Brahmin who was hungry, so he went to a Muslim and asked him if he could give me something to eat. So the Muslim gave him something to eat, and after it was finished, he said, "Can you give me more? My stomach is not full." He said, "No, I'm sorry, that's all I can give you." So the Hindu Brahmin said, "Well, I've lost my calf, and my stomach is also not full." So, in other words, he compromised. He's eating untouchable food because the untouchable person is giving him meat. So he's eating that, and still he's not full either. But be careful. When you take association, you may contaminate yourself, and you may not get what you were thinking you were going to get anyway. You were thinking, "I'll become very successful and millionaire, and I'll become popular." You may not even get that, and you've lost your spiritual principles. But then you've lost doubly. So better to hold on to your spiritual principles. Okay? We should know our parameters. It's very important to clarify to whom we are responsible and what are the parameters of our responsibility. This is something that comes up quite a bit in our spiritual lives too, because we don't know how far to go. So we may do something beyond our jurisdiction and we get in trouble. We get in big trouble when we go beyond that. Well, why did you tell that person? You were sworn to confidentiality. Now you went beyond, you told them. Now the whole company's at risk. Now whatever. So we have to be very mindful, very careful of knowing our parameters. And if we don't know what they are, we should clarify what we're allowed to do and what we're not allowed to do, what we're authorized to do. Some companies, for example, they allow lower executives to write checks, but only up to $100. More than that, they have to get signed by someone else. And then that person can write checks up to $5,000 and someone else up to $100. So in this way, they build in the parameters. But it's not always like that. They don't always build them in. Therefore, we need to clarify. We want to know what are those guidelines so that we can perform our duties and our activities properly. Because if we don't know, then we're not. How will we be able to do our duty properly? It's like if we do something, let's say we're put in charge of a particular project. So we think that some of the equipment that we have there is, not so good. So we just sell it. Now the boss comes sometime later and says, "Where's that equipment?" "I sold it." "Well, did you consult him?" "No. I figured I was in charge. I just sold it. I didn't need it." Well, the boss may have wanted him to be in charge using the equipment that was there. He didn't want him to sell it. He didn't want him to go that far. So, from both sides, when you're in charge, you need to clarify what the parameters of the person's responsibility is. And similarly, when we're the one that's taking the responsibility, we should clarify. What am I allowed to do? Can I do this? Check out your parameters. Can I go here? Can I go there? What time do I have? Do I have to work? Do I have to be at the same time every day? We want to know all these things. Okay. Now, here's a question. As one becomes more qualified, one's level of authority may change. How should one go about recognizing that? Alright, so the answer is, that there was a veterinarian. Prabhupada told this story. So a veterinarian, he was called to treat a horse that had a big lump in his throat. So the veterinarian came, he examined, he looked inside, then he took out a mallet, kind of like a hammer, and he started beating the neck of the horse. And after a little while, the lump went away, and the horse was healthy. Now, a few weeks later, his assistant, the assistant veterinarian, he was in some other place, some marketplace, and he saw an old man who had a lump on his neck. So he picked up his, you know, hammer and started whacking and, you know, beating the lump on the old man. And the police came and took him away. Finally, he was brought to the court. The judge said, you know, what? Why were you beating this old man with his hands? I learned it from the veterinarian. The veterinarian taught me how to do that. I said, what veterinarian? They called him in, they subpoenaed him to come to court. So the judge then said, all right, this man has said that you taught him how to beat the old man. It was an old man. I didn't teach him how to beat the old man. And the accused, the defendant said, yes, you did. Remember that horse that had the lump on his neck? You were beating it with the mallet? I watched it. I saw it with my own eyes. And so this old man had a lump, and I was going to cure him. Just like you cured that horse. Unfortunately, the old man died, but I was trying to do it that way. So the veterinarian said, no. That horse had swallowed a gourd. You know what a gourd is? A little pumpkin. So it just needed to be broken so he could swallow it. But this old man, he had some other disease. So then the judge said, oh, now I see. So what happened? The assistant, he didn't consult properly. He watched, but he formed his own view. He wasn't fully educated, but he thought. And first of all, he should have considered, well, I'm only an assistant veterinarian anyway. This is a man, this is not an animal. That's the first thing he should have considered. And he should have consulted. So because he didn't, he assumed that that he had the full knowledge. Prabhupada also said this about some of the Sanskrit scholars. He said they learn a little Sanskrit and they think they become big pundits, and now they can question spiritual master. So we have to be careful about a little bit of knowledge. We should know what our parameters are. There's a saying that fools rush in where wise men fear to tread. So, if out of pride we try to do more than we're qualified to do, we make a big mess. And this is really important in our lives, because if we do that, then it can really upset things. You know, we can lose our confidence, we can lose our service, our job, it can upset our family. Everything can be upset by that. We have to be very cautious. The next thing I wanted to discuss is the most confidential friend. Now, when it comes to consulting or taking counseling, we already have the best counselor sitting in our heart, the most confidential friend, Lord Krishna. Sarva-shit-cha-hum-vidhi-sang-vishto-tap-sit-tir-dhyam-apoha-nam-chat. He is right there in our heart. And he's always available. That's the problem with other counselors, that if it's late at night and you feel you need some counseling, you can't call them. They say, no, I'm not taking calls at this time. Fortunately, the counselor within the heart is always available. The Brahman. And we can consult. We can approach that Supreme Counselor through speaking with him, through meditating, through writing, through chanting, through praying. You can write a letter to the Super Soul in the heart. You can. He reciprocates. He reciprocates to your prayers, to your questions. Because if one yayatam prapajate tamsatayapajamyam, we're, although we may not be such exalted personalities, great devotees, whatever, but we're trying. We're making some effort to become servants. That much we have to take credit at least for that. We're trying. And Krishna recognizes that. This person's trying. So any magnanimous person is kind to his servant. We're trying to serve. Therefore, there's some relationship. And we have the right to present the problems that we're facing, the difficulties that we're facing, to that Supreme Counselor. And we have the right to get counseling. And he's willing to give that counseling. Not only is he willing, but he likes to. And he's so patient that he just goes on and on giving good advice, giving good counseling. Even when we keep making the same mistakes again and again. So we shouldn't overlook that counselor. You know, take advantage. You'll be surprised if you learn to pray and to write letters of prayer, or to go and speak. You may do it privately or whatever way, or just in the mind, but this is a very good way to take good counsel, because he always gives good counsel, and we may even request him to please influence me, even though my intelligence is so dull, I can't understand what you're trying to say, but please influence me in making the right decision, even if it's against my own will. Sometimes devotees pray like that. Even though I have these bad desires, I'm begging you, please overcome those bad desires. I'm asking you to take the power of attorney from you. Right? Isn't that kind of what a devotee does when he surrenders? What does surrender mean? It means, okay, I wave the white flag, I come out, and I say, okay, you're in charge now. I surrender my life to you. So we do that officially at a certain point. Initiation, of course, is a very dramatic turning point in our life. Because initiation means I surrender to Krishna. Okay? And I'm turning over my life to Krishna now. That's what it means. But we can't just say, we can't just rely on that, I surrendered so many years ago. We have to renew it. The contract has to be renewed all the time. I'm renewing it. I still want to surrender. I still want to take your guidance. I still want to be counseled by you every day. Okay? Now here's a question. If one is not qualified to hear the Super Soul, isn't it that the Super Soul may arrange for another person to advise us? And of course we know that's the case. That's our representative spiritual master, Vaishnava, etc. Now, the test of a seeker's sincerity is that he recognizes the truth when he hears it. There are those who go around seeking. They're like professional seekers. They want to hear a little bit here, they listen to this lecture, this seminar, read this book. But they just keep going on seeking. They're professional seekers. They don't really want to find anything. So when you're consulting from someone, you have a responsibility to take seriously what they say. If you're not going to take seriously what they say, it's your duty to let them know ahead of time. Do you know what I'm saying? For example, let's say there's something I can't decide. And it's a very big decision, and it's troubling me, and I want to take some counseling from someone. Now, to ask someone to get involved in my problem, helping me, that's quite an imposition. I'm asking them to spend, I'll give you an example once. At one point, it became necessary for me to take counseling from the GBC that was in charge of the zone that I was in. And, to me, the problems were quite weighty. I couldn't seem to make it. So it took several hours, this counseling session. Now, at the end of the counseling session, the devotee, he said, "Now, I've just spent 2.5 hours of my human form of life with you. And you better follow what I said. You better take it seriously." He didn't want it to be wasted. That's a good point. 2.5 hours of his human form of life, he invested in helping me. And if I was just going to take it lightly, he was not going to be pleased. And he let me know. So I had to take it very seriously. Not every counselor will do that, but it's true. So before you take counsel from someone, consider they're giving you their valuable time. And if you're not going to take it seriously, then why waste their time? It's not fair to them. And they'll be insulted. You spent this. I know myself, if someone comes to me and asks me for some advice on a particular subject, I get involved and I plan, they ask me, "How do you think I should go to this place?" And I say, "Well, the best way to go would be by car. This way, this way," and I spend half hour explaining. And they say, "I don't think I'll go anyway." "What do you mean you don't think you'll go? Why? You just wasted a half hour of my time. I'm telling you how to go there and you decide not to go." I'll be upset. I don't have time to waste. So when you take counseling, make sure that you're serious about following it. And if you're not, tell them ahead of time. For example, that person should have said, "I'm not sure whether I'm going to go or not go to this place. But if I did go, if I do decide to go, what would you think would be the best way to go?" Well, then my instruction would have been a lot shorter. It would have been real short. Probably like, "Well, let me know what you decide." No, I'm not going to waste my time. Half hour giving instructions how to get there, and he's not even sure if he's going to go. See the point? So let them know. It's only fair to them. And similarly, if you're giving counseling, you probably want to find out whether the person is serious to follow what you're going to say. Otherwise, you may spend all this time and energy giving detailed instruction. He has no intention of following what you're going to say. So why give him more than he needs? Maybe you just keep it something more simple. So, well, how in-depth or how intense do you want this discussion to be? Do you want me to counsel you? To what extent are you going to take my advice? It's important between the person consulting and the person counseling. They have to have some agreement on what the relationship is. And they should both be happy with that. "Okay, I'll give you some of my thoughts on the matter. And you can take them or leave them, that's fine. As long as I know that, I'm not offended. And as long as you know that." But when someone comes up and says, "I surrender," just like Arjuna. When Arjuna said, "Shadi Manatam Prabhupada, I surrender unto you, accept me as your disciple. Now I'm a soul surrendered." Well, that's the kind of thing that requires in-depth counseling. Krishna got real serious without instructing him. He instructed him on fighting, on his family, on every aspect, how to control his mind, how to control his senses, every detail, because this was a soul that was surrendered fully. So the counseling then went very deep. But if it's not so deep, and the person inquiring is just more casual, then that should be clear. Okay. Here's a question. So I said that if you take counseling from someone and you don't follow it, it's an insult to the counselor. But the question might be, well, what if a person takes advice from someone and he wants to follow it, but his mind is too strong? He's not able to. Is that an insult? The answer is no. If he's trying to follow, it's not an insult. As long as he's making a sincere effort, then he's not insulting the teacher. The teacher expects that the counselor expects that the counselee will not necessarily be able to follow everything perfectly. But he's, as long as he's trying, then it's all right. Any questions? There may be some exceptional cases when that happens, but if we've done our, shall we say, our homework, if we've done our preparation properly, we will already know what their credentials are. We're not going to be surprised. For example, that's why when accepting a spiritual master, we don't just accept in one day. It's not even recommended. Srila Sanatana Goswami recommends 1 year, minimum. But at least 1 year, where the prospective candidate observes carefully the spiritual master. And similarly, the spiritual master should observe the prospective candidate to see if they're both qualified. Okay. So that's in spiritual life. Now in other things, for example, if you go to a doctor, you want to know if it's a surgeon, let's say it's a very important operation you're considering getting, like a double bypass, or, you want someone who's really expert, not a newcomer, or not just someone who read a book. You will not submit yourself to someone, you'll go up and say, what do you know about double bypass? Well, I read a few articles on it. So go on to the next one, right? Not that you get in there and then in the middle of the operation, say, ow, that hurts. What are your qualifications? Well, you don't ask in the middle or afterwards. Someone says, so you got the double bypass? Yes. Well, was the doctor called? I don't know. I didn't check. Let me check now. Don't check after. Check before. It's a serious operation. When you're taking counseling, what could be more serious in your life than someone who's you're opening your ears and they're just pouring in. And you're taking it very submissively. That's why training children is so important, because they're just completely open. They just open their ears. And it's very important that the parents select who they associate with, who they imbibe things from, because children can't discriminate. They'll hear from anyone. Parents have to say, okay, you don't hear me. Come over here, you stay with these. Not there. Okay. The child just accepts wherever you put it. So similarly, we want that childlike innocence and that childlike willingness to accept, but we don't want to be naive or foolish. Therefore, we have to check ahead of time. Before we, what are this person's qualifications? If you don't, you'll be disappointed. You'll be cheated.
Some of my experience is that it's, when you have some time as a devotee and when you have a problem, actually you already, how can you say, know the answer and the solution to it.
you don't have like the power to do it or whatever. And then sometimes it's like a difficult situation, like to find something to consult with, because you already know the answer somehow or other. You know what's coming. And then it's like you don't know if you have to go, because you already know the answer and you're not following the solution that you already know. Wow. So why go to waste another person's
okay,
time?
Okay, that's a good question. But you can do it as long as you clarify that in the beginning. You should clarify that. You should, if you go to a counselor and say to someone, say, there's an issue that I've been counseled on before. I've been giving good advice. I think I know what I'm supposed to do, but I'm unable to execute it. Could I bring it before you again for further insight? Could I bring it before you for you to consider, and maybe you can help me learn how? Because basically what's happening is you understand it, but not fully. You don't really understand completely, otherwise you could do it. So you're understanding partially. You could say, I partially understand what I think I'm supposed to do, but I can't seem to do it. Could you help me maybe get so I can do it? So that's fine. Counselor will respect that very much. He will be very happy to counsel you, because it's so clear. You've made everything clear now. You admitted that you've already been counseled on the same subject. You've admitted that you think you know it. You've tipped off. That's good, because he'll like to know that. You think you know, but he may find out that you don't understand it at all. But anyway, he may also agree that you understand partially, and he may give you some other insights from other directions to help you understand. So that's fine, because you're being honest. You're presenting yourself, and you're subjecting yourself. He may point out some flaws in your analysis, and you're willing to accept it, because you've asked him for counseling. When you accept the counselor, it means you have to accept that he may point out some flaws in your character. Don't think he's going to only, tell you how nice you are. If you're not willing to take some criticism, then don't go to a counselor. Don't even waste your time. Don't waste his time. Don't try to impose that he has to tell you what you want to hear. Otherwise, you're just cheating. If I know that someone comes to me asking me, and they only want one answer, I won't even bother. I'll say, I'll find some excuse, I don't want to counsel. Because, how can I counsel when I have to counsel according to his desire? Otherwise he's going to become upset with me. If I tell him something that he doesn't want to hear, he'll criticize me, or, I don't know, why should I? Well, sometimes I may clarify. Well, it's like one time, someone asked Prabhupada. They said, Prabhupada or Swamiji or something, are you in touch with Krishna? Do you know Krishna? And Prabhupada could see this was those type of questions where you hesitate to, don't cast your pearls before the swine. So he was a little hesitating. So he said, well, will you believe me if I tell you? So he put a question back. He wanted to qualify the person being counseled. And the person said, oh, yes, Swamiji, I will. That's probably, yes, I've seen Krishna at every moment. I'm taking you. Because that was the Prabhupada tested the candidate, the hearer, whether he actually had faith. And once he saw that he did, then he told him, yes. He revealed so much to him. But if the person didn't have the qualification, Prabhupada wouldn't. It's like in another case, there was a husband and wife in India, and they were meeting with Prabhupada. They said, oh, Swamiji, you're Prabhupada. Please tell us about Krishna's pastimes with the gopis, Rasa Lila. Prabhupada said, I'm not qualified. They said, oh, yes, Swamiji, you're qualified. And we want so much to hear about Rasa Lila. I said, I am not qualified. They said, oh, Swami, we know you're qualified. Prabhupada said, you may be qualified, but I'm not qualified. He would not agree. He would not be forced into account, because he could see they were superficial. They were not sincere. They didn't consider whether they were qualified to hear. So, see, that wasn't an honest, wasn't a proper situation for Prabhupada to reveal. Other questions? On what?
In the area.
Right, the area. If it's done properly. Just like when a girl gets married, okay? She goes and lives with the husband. Now she has to follow the husband. But that doesn't mean she gives up her relationship with her father. But the father doesn't advise her the same way that he did when she was under his care. Now, he will advise her in a more general way, in a loving way as a father, but not as her direct authority. He will not interfere. Unless it's an emergency. Now, if there's an emergency, then you may even interfere. There may be some cases of that. But we're talking about general principles, right? Not some big emergency where the president, has gone mad or something. Then the guru may have to interfere. But we don't expect that to happen, okay? Although it happened a few... and when it did happen, Prabhupada expected the devotees to ascertain that something was wrong. There was one instance in the old, it was an extraordinary situation. The leader and his wife were actually even meeting. It was unbelievable. This was going on. And when it came to Prabhupada's notice, he was very happy with the devotees who found it out and pointed it out. And didn't, agree to. So in other words, we don't want to be naive either, and to misled. But we shouldn't be so critical and so ready to find fault that we go overboard. That's my point. So in other words, you have to keep a balance. Generally speaking, if the president asks me to go on sankirtan, I don't have to think, is this instruction, something I have to follow, or is this, I have to check with my guru on this one. Okay? So, but there's a right way to do it. And we, you, have to be careful not to play one against the other. It's like, the story of a child. A child has a mother and a father. So, the child can be mischievous. And the child may go to the mother and say, Dad said it's okay for me to go out tonight. Is it okay with you too? Mother says, yes. Now later on, the father says to the mother, where's Billy? Well, he went out. I told him to stay out. Well, why did you stay out? Well, he said, you said that you gave approval. I never said I gave approval. I didn't. He told me he wanted to go, but I didn't give approval. You see? So the boy, he took advantage of the father and he played to the mother. So now it's created a disturbance. And sometimes those disturbances, if the person like yourself is not careful, it can cause dissension between the other two authorities. So you have to be very careful not to do that. Not to play one against the other or to misrepresent one. For example, one may confide in you. One may say, I think that you should do the sankirtan like this. You may say, well, my guru said that sankirtan should be done like this. Well, now you're causing dissension now. Because if your guru was present, he might not say exactly what you're saying he said. Because there's many other factors that you're not taking into consideration. And you may be even taking it out of context. You may not even be understanding what he meant. So many things. But because you're doing that, you may be causing now friction between the present, one authority and the other. Unfairly, and I'll tell you, there's nothing a guru dislikes more than a disciple who does that. And there's nothing a president dislikes more than someone who's causing that kind of polarity. Okay? So we have to be, you know, a good disciple. You have to be very intelligent and careful, and a good temple devotee, so that you don't cause deception, but rather you try to make the relationships very sweet and try to help them. Right? A good child, he gets along well with mother and father, and mother and father get along well, and they're all happy. Is that good? It's not that one has to be in conflict with the other. The father, whose daughter has moved away now and has gotten married, his instruction will be, you know, more kind of broad, philosophical, but not so much practical anymore. Because the husband's supposed to take charge of that. I know many gurus in our movement, when they have female disciples, they, of course, they give some spiritual advice and things, but when it comes to practical matters, they entrust that to the husband. They don't get involved. And there have been some instances where they do get very much involved and cause their problems. So one has to be careful. And if you notice, Prabhupada also, once someone got married, I remember there was a letter Prabhupada wrote to one newly married person, man. And he said, now that you are married, your wife shall do whatever you say, and you shall be as her guru. So he said, you will be her guru. So even though Prabhupada was her initiating guru, but he had designated now this person as her husband to be like her siksha guru and to act under his direction. And now, he, as the spiritual father, was relieved of having to deal with everything in instructing him. You see? And that's fine. But that doesn't mean that the disciple, the female disciple, couldn't write to Prabhupada, couldn't take instruction from him. But it should be done in such a way that they don't conflict. Okay, they're compatible. That means the person must be very sincere. He really wants to understand. He doesn't want to create friction. He doesn't want to. And he's not attached to doing things his own way. So much so that he would use one to get against the other to get his way. Let's say I don't want to go on sankirtan. Okay? So the president says, Prabhu, I'd like you to go on sankirtan today. Say, my guru said deity worship is most important. You know, that's completely out of context. It may be true, he may have said that, and then at the same time the president said, yeah, of course I agree that deity worship is very important. But sankirtan, you know, shooting books is also important. The person might say, well, my spiritual master said that sometimes there's really misused tactics on sankirtan. They sometimes cheat people. Therefore we get a bad image. But in other words, you don't want to go on sankirtan, so you're using all these statements to support your case. But it's not fair. Because you're not representing him properly. Okay? And you should take it on your own. Say, Prabhu, my mind is disturbed, I don't want to go on sankirtan. Okay, at least you're being honest now. But when you drag in the guru and give some out of context, fragmented, maybe even misunderstood statements, you're going to cause problems. Okay? Yes?
Can you say a little bit more about the relationship, you say something like that. Write a letter. Oh, yeah, letter
from Paramatma. You can write a letter from Paramatma.
And if, actually, then you're really qualified for the
relationship. What?
When you're really qualified.
When are you qualified to have a relationship? Well, you already have a relationship. He's the dear most friend. The Upanishads say that they compare the Suparna and the super soul and the individual soul are like two friendly birds sitting on the same tree. And the super soul, one bird, is always instructing, and the other bird is busy eating fruit. So the relationship is already there, it's established. He is the dear most friend. But now we have to stop eating fruits long enough to hear what he's telling us, to take it. But, so if we have a good moment or two, and we realize that, and we think of super soul, generally we're forgetting all about super soul, busy, you know, doing whatever we're doing. But if we have a few good minutes, and we actually remember that I'm subordinate and super soul there, why not take advantage and supplicate, you know, present ourselves before him humbly, say, my Lord, now I realize you're there. I've forgotten you for so long. Now please, that's good. That's a good step. And you may not get all of his advice, but you might get some of it. That's a good step. Other points? Okay, let's discuss etiquette for a few minutes, because the reason I'm mentioning etiquette is that we can take counsel from someone without necessarily asking them questions or without them speaking to us. You can take counsel from someone just by watching them or associating with them. When I was a new devotee, first few days, the person who was taking care of me, he said, "You want to make a lot of advancement?" I said, "Yes." He said, "See that devotee? Watch that devotee. Just watch him. And you will make a lot of advancement. You will learn what devotional service is all about." He didn't tell me to go and ask him questions. He said, "Just watch. Watch how he performs the service." And I did. And it was incredible. So, by watching him, I was getting counsel. He was so intense. He never wasted time. He never talked frivolous. He never was always gentle. All these good qualities. So I learned that by just watching him, just by associating. So that's one way. Now there's another way to take counsel. By doing some service for a superior person. And I'll give the example of myself. That when I was young, I was into athletics. And in the particular sport I was into, as a child, the other players would be hitting balls, and I would chase the balls and bring them back to them. So I was helping them. They didn't have to run after the balls. I was like a ball boy. So what happened? Well, by doing that, I didn't ask them any questions, they didn't counsel me, but I won their blessings. They were pleased with me. And so they gave their blessing. You may say, well, that's some kind of intangible thing, blessings. No, but blessings are not intangible. They may be intangible to a gross person, but no, they were real. Not only that, I had their well wishes. They were my well, they appreciated. They cared. And I had their friendship. So, all those things, by their blessings, I actually developed the abilities that they had. And this is our philosophy. Isn't it? How do we get the good qualities of the Vaishnavas? By their blessings. So we have to please them. Yasyam sara, paribhakti sara, yasyam namatikatoki. Without pleasing the spiritual master, no one can please Krishna. If one pleases the spiritual master and the other man, they please Krishna. He'll get the good qualities. So, just by serving or assisting someone with good intelligence or good quality, you'll get their blessings. And their blessings means you'll get their opulences. For example, when Arjuna went to the heavenly planets, he had such good qualities. He was so humble and so nice that many of the demigods, they just bestowed their blessings in the form of weapons. They gave, Shiva gave a weapon, Indra gave a weapon, others gave blessing, someone gave a chariot, someone said this, that. All his blessings were showered on him. So blessings are tangible, especially when blessings come from a very qualified person. So keep good etiquette, serve nicely, and you'll be amazed. You get so much wealth in return. You get all the good qualities. Okay, now let's discuss duty and etiquette, because that's demigods are very nice. But what about when duty and etiquette come in conflict? Well, they apparently come in conflict. For example, Arjuna was supposed to fight against his superiors. It was a big problem. How to do it? How to deal with etiquette and duty? His duty was to fight, but the etiquette was to show respect. So what did he do? Before he fought, he shot an arrow right under the lotus feet of Dromacharya's teacher, offering respect. Dromacharya shot an arrow, just touching the top of the head of Arjuna, offering blessings. Because the guru offers blessings to the head. So they both followed the etiquette, and then they fought like everything, trying to kill each other. So we have to keep duty and etiquette. For example, the duty was, as Chakyus, they fought, both sides fought, but at night, when one side would go to the other, to their home, they'd, "Oh, brother, please come in, sit down, bring him a nice meal." You know, everything. They were sitting as friends. That's the etiquette. But during fighting, fought to kill. So duty and etiquette have to be adjusted. Another example was, Arjuna had captured Ashwatthama, and he had vowed to kill for his heinous act of killing sleeping Sarathi. Now, he was about to cut off his head. Draupadi said, "Please don't." Krishna said, "Don't." No, Bhima said, "Kill him." Yudhisthira said, "Don't kill him." Krishna said, "You should be killed, but you also have to satisfy Yudhisthira and Draupadi." So now you decide. So that's a big question. So what did he do? He cut off the jewel of his head. So that was killing and not killing at the same time. He did the duty. Krishna told him to kill him. But that was such a disrespectful act, he didn't have to, but there's no injunction for killing the body. So sometimes you'll notice that you're faced with what appears to be a dilemma. Should I follow etiquette or duty? And the answer is you should try to do both. There's a way to do both. Etiquette should always be followed, but duty as well. Okay? We have a few more minutes. If there's any other questions on any of the topics we've discussed.
Can you say some practical example of how can you give some practical example of life?
Okay, let's say you want a practical example, duty and etiquette. So let's say you're carrying two plates of deity trays, and you're quickly going to perform an arti, and you see a sannyasi for the first time in the day. And you could pay dandavats or something, but both plates will fall and be late for the arti. Or you could offer respects in your mind. So you've done both. Done your duty, or there may be even sometimes you're performing your arti, and it says in the Metta Devotion that if a great personality comes, one may even temporarily put aside the worship of the deity to receive the guest. Of course, that's not to be done all the time, but there may be an extraordinary circumstance. So sometimes you may do that. Krishna as super soul will guide us, and of course, the more learned we are, the more we have transcendental knowledge, and the more we're surrendered to Krishna, the more Krishna will guide us how to deal with all these circumstances that come up. It's like, for example, say I'm sitting in a class, and the class is going overtime. Okay. Now, I don't want to be disrespectful to the speaker, but then again, let's say I have some very important service that I have to perform at a specific time. Let's say I have an appointment. Well, what to do? I could say, Maharaj, please stop the class. That's one way to deal with it. That may not be the best way. Or another way might be, I offer, you know, the businesses and I quietly go out. And maybe later I mention, after, you know, later on the day, I say, Maharaj, I'm sorry I had to leave early. Or leave the class because it was an appointment. So then you've done both. You took care of your duty, but at the same time you didn't forego the proper etiquette. You realized that leaving a class was a little disrespectful. You didn't want to do it, but you had to do it. Okay? Anything else?
Sometimes there is a conflict between duty and etiquette. So an example, something that comes to mind is that sometimes when you're sharing prasadam and there's a big crowd and it's just a few
serving
of you. Yeah, serving prasadam. And there's a big crowd and it's just a few of you serving. Then you have to get the serving out. It means something you cannot follow all the proper etiquette.
Such as?
Like make sure you don't touch, you know, the serving utensils, don't touch. You know, you have so many people waiting and there's a big festival or something and you have to get the service out. But you cannot follow all the rules and regulations at that point. There is a little conflict there in terms of the etiquette and your duty to our
people. Well, you should be expert. You should be able to serve the person without touching the money. That doesn't take much more expertise. It just means you're not careful enough. In other words, it may be a little harder, but that's what Krishna consciousness means. It means you have to live your life a little more carefully than the others. It may seem difficult. See my point?
Yes, man. The other thing is that if you might be taking out a sadhu or something, but because you have to do it so quickly, you might just like kind of dump it.
There may be some emergency situation. Okay. But that shouldn't be taken as an excuse for being careless or lazy. If there's some emergency, anything can be done. You know, you can do whatever has to be done to solve the emergency. But it shouldn't be taken advantage of. See my point? Yeah. So is it really an emergency, or is it just that it's a little bit more trouble? And it may just be a little more trouble, and it may require us to be a little bit more willing.
I have here in the Puja course, he says, Mr. Puja Swami, he's giving, if we make this kind of, we touch the place with spoon, so immediately we go out and wash the spoon after there, so I meet that we have done something wrong also.
If
we touch a plate, we give prasadam out on that.
I don't think that's the issue. I don't think the real issue is.
But I here we have to wash the spoon after, so.
No, but that's not the issue. The issue is that he's bringing up is when can we supersede a normal etiquette? And I say, if there's an emergency, yes, no one will mind. You can do what you have to do. It's like Arjuna. One time, and I'll end on this point, okay? There was an agreement between the five brothers. They were all husbands of Draupadi. The agreement was that if Draupadi's ever alone with one of the brothers, if any of the others enters into their company, that brother will have to go for 1 year in exile. And it was a strict policy, so no one would interrupt the others. The etiquette was there. They had made a vow, and they were all following. But one day, there was some attack, and someone was being mistreated, and Arjuna had to go and protect them, but his bow was in the tent where Yudhisthira was sitting with Draupadi alone. What to do? He knows if I go in, I'll have to leave for a year. If I don't do it, these people will be mistreated. But what to do? So he went in, he took the bow, he went out, he defeated the miscreants, and he went back, and he said to Yudhishthira, "Now I'm leaving for a year." And Yudhishthira said, "No, no, no. You don't have to leave. You did the right thing. I'm not at all offended." And he said, "No, this is..." So he left. Okay. So he did his duty. He bypassed the etiquette because it was an emergency. But at the same time, he followed. He did the right thing. So I think we'll stop on that point.
I just want to say thanks for that. Good and inspiring and clarifying and useful seminar.
Thank you very much. I'll go to Shilpa.